Sunstone presents this live recording from the 1987 Sunstone Theological Symposium, held August 26th through the 29th. We take you to the Marriott Hotel in Salt Lake City, Utah, where the program is just now beginning.
I'm Collins, and I'm the editor of Ebony Rose Magazine. The members of the panelists that are here, there's two more that are coming, and they'll come screeching through the door, I know, in a few moments. But the panelists that are here right now are Natalie Palmer Taylor, who's sitting here. And there's a correction in the bulletin. She is not in word processing. She's a management services coordinator at the Capitol Building for the Utah State. And also, there's, how can I do that? Victoria Harris, who is the disc jockey at KZAN radio station in Ogden. And I work at Eastern Airlines. We're real happy to be here with you this morning, and I want to read something that I wrote in the form of an introduction. We've been asked to come here today to voice opinions and feelings. We've been told we would be on a panel and open ourselves up to questions from the audience. In doing so, we collectively ask that you, too, open yourselves up to what you'll hear. From my personal contact with each of the panelists, I do know that what you hear will be honest, thought-provoking, sincere, reflective, and from our hearts. We have endured, and the end is not in sight, so we endure by the day. Each new dawn brings prayers for us to be able to handle the day, and with that prayer, we aren't expecting negatives. On the contrary, we are asking for the strength to be able to handle anything that comes our way. In talking to each of the panelists, I've come to the conclusion that we are not only on this earth to finish out this stage of probation, but we seem to have taken on a special assignment by virtue of our skin color to educate as well as be educated by those who don't understand compassion, unconditional love of thy neighbor, and kindness. We've taken on this additional assignment, and in my own case, possibly to work off some past mistakes. I believe we've taken this assignment on because of the degree of lessons and levels of progression we've achieved to get where we are. If it were not for these achievements, I'm sure we would have not only made some degrading comments to various residents, but I dare say a few of us would have been before a judge to defend our actions. Being LDS has taught me much about forgiveness and the unimportance of getting back at someone for their ignorance. I learned to let go and let God long before I joined the church, and now I know why. Personal inventory was and is a daily ritual. Now, that's not to say that there's been a lot of only negatives that have come into our lives just because we've either come to Utah or joined the church. In fact, it's been quite the opposite. But I believe that because of the membership that we have that we've enjoyed in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, we as a group have been able to handle different situations that have come toward us a lot better than we would have before we joined the church. I'm going to turn the time now over to Natalie Palmer Taylor and let her give a little introduction to herself, and then we'll go to Victoria and do the same thing, and then we'll take questions from the audience. I'm going to need to repeat the questions that you ask as they come from you, because this whole session is being taped. So you'll have to bear with me while I do that for you, okay? Natalie, you can sit there if you like. That microphone will pick it up. It will. Mm-hmm.
You go. My name is Natalie Palmer Taylor, and I am a single parent, one son. I graduated from the University of Utah with a major in sociology, a minor in psychology, with a criminology certificate in June of 86. I've been a member of the church for 5.5 years. And my position is I work for the State of Utah Division of Data Processing as a management services coordinator. And,
that's fine. And I'm Victoria Harris, as Barbara mentioned. I'm working as a DJ with KZAN Country 98. So if you'd like, you can tune in 6 to midnight. You're owl like me. I just got off the air, so if I pass out, just throw some water on me, Natalie. Revive me or something. I graduated from Cal State University with a music degree and opera minor, and sang with the Tabernacle Choir for about 1.5 years, and then thought broadcasting was for me. And here I am. Oh, and I've been in the church for 8 years.
Okay, is that it? Okay, I too have been in the church for 10 years. I have two daughters, and I too am a single parent. My children and I joined the church in Montana, and the day we joined was the day of the revelation for black members of the church. And it was, for us, it was important because it wasn't that important that the revelation came because we didn't know what it meant. But it was important for us because it made a definite change in our lives in the way we treated each other and the different goals that I suddenly had obtained being a parent to my children. I'm currently working at Eastern Airlines here in Salt Lake City, and I'm never home. So now we'll take questions from the audience, and as the other two panelists come in, we'll have them introduce themselves too when they do that. Does anyone have any questions they'd like to present to us? Yes.
Tell us about Ebony Rose.
Okay. The question was, what I tell them about Ebony Rose? Ebony Rose started in Oakland, California, about 30 months ago, and it started. Actually, the year before that, in Montana, when my children and I joined the church, we were wondering if there were any other black members in the church. And because we joined in Montana, I think there were probably three families in all of Montana that were black, and we were one of them. And so when we joined the church, we thought we must be the only ones in the whole world in the church. And so we wrote President Campbell to ask him if there were any other black members, and he sent me a notice about a group here in Salt Lake that was meeting, and we eventually joined the group and started corresponding with them. And when we moved to Salt Lake, we attended the meetings and were regular members of the group. But we also wanted to know, quite selfishly, where the black men were. And if there was a way that we could connect black people that were in the church together, no matter where they were. And so my daughters and I thought, well, let's see if we can start a newsletter, just a small little newsletter, and see if we can get people connected. We'll collect names and addresses, and we'll send the newsletter out to them once a month. And we started doing that, and it started out with three members in the Oakland area that we were sending this newsletter to, and actually it was nothing more than a travel log, and different names and addresses started rolling in, and I had told my oldest daughter, who was living in Utah at the time, that what I wanted to do was to get a national magazine going, just a little national magazine. And I called her about 6 months later to tell her that it was now international. We had gotten some mail from England from three bishops there that were black, and they wanted to know more about Ebony Rose, and one of them had gotten a copy of it and put it on his door at the ward house so that other members could see what was going on in America. And so we had gone international in 6 months, and now we're in like 22 states and four countries altogether. Anyone else? We're going to lay some heavy speeches on you if you don't yet.
I was wondering if any of you participants were able to attend the conference for black members of the church that was held here, I believe, this past spring. I saw something about it in Sunstone. And if so, what were your reaction to the presentations that were given at that event?
I didn't attend either.
Ebony Rose sponsored that. And the comments that came from the participants was really amazing. And first of all, the facilitators of the different workshops that we had going were so amazing and so well had well planned everything that they had brought forth. Chester Hawkins had done so much research on black history in the church. He's written a couple of books about and putting that information out. And one of them is I Ain't Never Lied. I think it was I Ain't Never Lied. I forgot the exact name of it, but it's something like that. And he talked about the very first black person that came across the plains with Brigham Young and was driving the wagon. And the information that he gave us was like, there's no need for our children not to have that information, and there's no need for our children to go through a Utah education and have to be taught Utah history and not hear that. It's amazing that he isn't that his book or the information that he had isn't more widespread, so that people don't think that what we do in the church is all that black people do. You know, there's lots of things that have been done, and the participants were really amazed. There were people that came from Washington, D.C., California, Virginia, and all of us took the information down and took it back to either prospective groups or other people that we knew in the areas that they came from. They were amazed at the amount of information that came out of it. And even with Sister Bankhead, who has been in the church probably 70 years, it's amazing, this woman, this little lady, you know, and she was telling us her history about how she was baptized, and it wasn't in a tabernacle, and it wasn't in a ward building, and it was actually in a ditch, because she kept bugging her uncle about being baptized in this church that she knew had the right principles, had the correct principles, and she wanted to be a part of it. And she was baptized in a ditch. And she came home, and her mother had sent her out in this beautiful dress that morning, you know, and she came home that day and she was just drenched. But she was a member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, finally. And it was that kind of caring testimony and that kind of feeling that came from people that have been doing this a long time, a lot longer than we've even heard about it. Yes.
As oral historian, I'm going to ask a very broad open question.
Okay.
And I'd like all of you to comment about what you've learned in the church, what have been your positive and what have been your negative.
Go now. that is a very...
You walk through and go anywhere you want.
I know, but... Starting, beginning. What I've learned in the church. Joining the church, hopefully I'll answer this, okay? Maybe I'll go around it somewhere. But I've learned love and care, loving and caring. And that's just as broad an answer as your question was. But prior to joining the church, I really... As I reflect back on my life prior to joining the church, it's kind of hard to believe that I'm the same person as I was then. But it taught me love and care, and most of all that people are the same wherever you go. Because I joined the church in Cincinnati, Ohio, and like so many people, converts to the church that I've met since being in Utah, I came to the land of Zion, expecting a land of Zion and receiving a rude awakening. But through the struggle of experiencing total culture shock, of wondering what church did I join, some other church, maybe I should go back and find out which church I joined and start all over again. In the process of all the anger and the hatred that I felt and experienced in about the first 6 months that I was here, I had to do a paper. I was taking a class at the University of Utah that Problems in Human Values, which dealt with minorities in Utah. And I had to write a paper, and the paper had to tell your preconceived ideas of Utah and then your ideas once you had come. And it wasn't until I was writing the paper, because I was still very bitter and very angry, and it wasn't until I was writing the paper that I realized how much I had changed in 6 months. Because when I first came here, my son, for the first time in his life, experienced racism. Which, the reason he hadn't in Ohio, whereas I had all my life, was because by the time he was born, it just wasn't so latent. But he experienced it for the first time here, which was hard for me, and I had to deal with that through him. But in dealing with it and in listening to members and non-members of the church here, I learned that, like I said, people are the same wherever you go, and that it doesn't really matter. I mean, I wouldn't have even had such a hard time to deal with it if I wouldn't have been expecting so much. And once I met non-members and members of the church after being here in that 6-month period, I learned that there's a lot of love that people have to give, and you have to, if you're, what happened, I have to kind of back up a little bit. What happened was, as a result of my initial treatment in Utah, I became very cold and bitter. And then I joined the ward that I'm in now. I began to go to that ward, and I said, oh, these people are so unfriendly. And then as I progressed and as I was writing that paper, I realized it wasn't the people that were being unfriendly to me. It was me who was, I was not allowing myself to give to these people what I wanted in return. And I realized that if you don't give love, you don't receive it. So I did. That's what I learned. I learned that you have to give what you want in life. So I don't know. What was the second part of the question? I told you, I have to go all around to...
What are your positive and what are some negative
experiences? I don't know. I've experienced a lot of negativeness, but only in the beginning. And when I first came here, like I said, originally I planned to come here alone and find out what was going on, but then a family that I didn't really know, but their son was on a mission in Ohio, and he invited us to come and stay with them. And the negative experience that I had just living there with them in that area was the prejudice that, like I said, I thought that had died years ago. And when I came here, I felt like I had stepped way back in time, and to have to deal with it all over again, but not because I couldn't deal with it, but to have to deal with it through a 5-year-old child who was totally thrown as to what was even going on. I experienced a lot of negativeness there, and I, as a result of that experience, I really resented the first month or so that I was here. I really resented Mormons, Utah, just the whole thing. And never allowing myself, it was the anger that I allowed to build up within myself. And I went to, this is a wild story. I went, as a result of the way that I was treated, I went to the church office building and at that time demanded to see the prophet of the church. And they thought I was crazy. You know? And I said, well, if Jesus Christ and Heavenly Father could visit Joseph Smith, I certainly can see the prophet of the church. But instead, they just brought three of the apostles of the church, because at that time, President Kimball wasn't very well. So which one of the members was is the president of the church now, Ezra Taft Benson. At the time, he wasn't. And I was just this really screaming, hateful individual. And I said, well, none of you are the prophet. I really don't want to talk to you. And I screamed and performed, and I mean, as I look back, how embarrassing. As I think back on it, how embarrassing that was. But at the time, I felt like I had a worthy cause, and I felt like I had been mistreated, and I had come to this land where I was supposed to be treated. I mean, of course, everybody's Mormon, and I'm Mormon. I'm supposed to be treated like someone special. And after talking to them and being told that if you join the church for the people in the church, then you didn't join the church for the right reasons anyway. And somewhere along, I'm screaming and they're talking real calm. You know, and I had to stop screaming in order to hear what they were saying to me. I had to stop talking to listen. And the things that all the negativeness that I felt when I walked into that room, when I left there, I was a very humble individual. And I realized that I did have to reevaluate me and determine why I joined the church in the first place. And if I joined the church because I had a testimony of the church, then no human being on earth can take that away from me. So other than that initial, from that point on in my life, I began to look at the positive. And I think that it's so important for all of us to look for the Christ in every individual that we meet. Because when you look for it, that's what you portray in return. So other than that, I haven't experienced much negativeness because of my attitude.
Well, for me, associating the scriptures and some of the hymns, such as, O my Father, thou that dwellest in the high and glorious place. Well, for many Black American children, they don't even know who their natural worldly father is. So I think the possibility of having a heavenly father is a little far-fetched for them. And having a single-parent family, a lot of people do dream the impossible dream, and they create for themselves disappointment, isolation, rejection. And many blacks have a difficult time tracing their genealogy because of it. The other hymn, In the Heavens Our Parents Single, a lot of black mothers who are raising children solidarily will, and working outside of the home, will tell you that they're used to being independent and lonely. And if you tell her there's a husband waiting for her in the celestial kingdom if she's worthy, she'll probably tell you that she's tired of getting life's leftovers and that she won't be a secondhand celestial rose for anybody. And she might even ask you if you're on drugs. The children's primary hymn, Families Can Be Together Forever. Well, a lot of black American families aren't even together here and now. So again, that sort of puts you out in left field dreaming again, and you think, well, why don't we get a dress rehearsal? You know, can't we have a family here now so that, you know, all the whites seem to be ahead. You know, they're used to being a family. We're not, you know. We haven't had opportunities during slavery, the period 1620 to 1865. The black family unit was split. So it's very difficult to deal with a concept of having an eternal family unit when we can't even seem to get it together here on earth. And so we just feel like we're just so far behind you. Education opportunities, training opportunities, has really left a mark, and we feel, yeah, is it a result of our skin tone? Is it the skin tone that makes us discriminated against, or is it just all of this repression that makes us discriminated against? We don't know what's happening. We grovel. The black has to grovel for the slice of the proverbial pie in the sky dream, the American dream, and now we seem to be tempted by the promises of Mormonism, which seemed to be much greater, to have a greater value. And it seemed for me, myself, something I really wanted to attain. But I still somehow feel like I'm just Pollyanna, I'm just searching for the impossible dream. Is it really there? And I don't think these problems are just limited to the black American. I think perhaps dark races all over the globe, because of their exposure to Western civilization and the white culture, has this sense of frustration, because we live, the black American lives in the land of opportunity. I mean, opportunities just seems to be right outside of our grasp. And here, the African, whenever I hear the black American always being discussed in the same breath about the African, the hair on the back of my neck just stands. Because we're so different. We've been bitten by the bug of materialism. We've seen what we can attain. While the African is so innocent, he's somewhat unsophisticated. He's been exposed, he's been exploited, mind you, by the white industry coming into his country. But I think his naivety causes him to convert to the church a little more. Whereas I really get angry, because why aren't the black Americans doing it, you know? I did it. I felt that, yes, perhaps it has something to offer me that I could not get within my own family unit. I mean, we went to church. We did all of these lovely things. But I felt like it was a routinized, traditional thing, obeying your mother and father type of thing. But to me, I felt it needed to be a much further commitment, that you have to internalize it. Spiritually, intellectually. I mean, I wanted it all. I mean, I want everything. I'm very greedy. You can tell I've been bitten. You know, America is a glamorous, glorious place. And I think, yeah, the very basis of our Constitution tells us that. The inspiration that we've had. And by golly, if we can be a celestial kingdom, shoot, let's go for it. Perhaps not in the worldly way that I've outlined, but that's how I feel. And I feel that while the African is exploited, he's living in poverty, and he's depending on the white missionary and white technology to increase his livelihood. And I look at the white, the black American always groveling, and I really wonder who's better off, they or we. And then when I hear the hymn, "There's beauty all around when there's love at home," well, home is where the heart is, but some Black Americans are forced to live in low-income housing. They're surrounded by drugs, poverty, filth, crime, and lack of opportunity, perhaps because of lack of education. And a child who's born under such conditions can only have confidence and faith in himself that he has inner strength, that he can develop courage and self-assurance and dignity to say himself that he is lovable because of who he is, not because of the things around me or the material trappings that his parents have been able to give him, because of the things that he has or does not have, but just by the mere nature of his birth, that he's a human being, he's a flesh and blood person. And I think such a child can receive, like Natalie and Marvin, myself, and the people here in this room, you've all received this cosmic spark from the universe that tells you, yeah, there is an afterlife. There is an eternal being. There is someone out there I can love that can love me back and that can help me love other people. But then, as a child, you might be told that because of the foul-up of some distant ancestor a long time ago, and all of these ancestors' descendants are going to be cursed. And then you kind of think, well, why me, Lord? You know, why should this happen to me? But then again, in 1978, these people come to you and tell you, oh, you know, it was an oversight, it was red tape or something, and you can go to the celestial kingdom. You're as good as we are. We are the only ones that have this knowledge, and so we have the responsibility to tell you that you can go to the celestial kingdom. And we, by way of the temple, of course, that now you can go and do all of these wonderful things, but don't touch the golden plates. Honey, would you hide the silver? And do not collect $200, but give us 10% of your unemployment check, or more if you can. Oh, honey, what's the world coming to? Look, they're sitting in our pew, dear. Lock the car door. You never know what these crazy blank blanks will do. Wow, get a load of the hooters on that Black chick over there. She must be a hooker. Blacks aren't supposed to dress better than we are. I mean, gosh, where would she get money anyway?
Gee, there's a Black man over there. Let's stare at him, Edith. You know, Ruth, I wonder if it's true what they say. Are Black men really, you know?
But no, this is a caricaturization. Don't be offended by it. But my own feeling is that I'm trying to say is that no matter how beautiful the Black child is, no matter how much education he gets, no matter how spiritual he tries to become, no matter how talented he is, he lives in these clean, supposedly safe, moral, decent, middle class, wholesome, upwardly mobile, civilized environment. But because of his skin tone, he's always judged in a negative light. And it makes us expect negativity. I mean, when I joined the church, I was so defensive. And I just felt like, you know, let's get it. You know, I want more negativity. I want more insults. Come on, you know, I'm ready for you. I always had my boxing gloves on. Go ahead.
Where are you getting insults from other non-LDS Blacks? Because I had a Black roommate in San Jose who was a member of the church, and there were three of us, myself and him and a Hispanic fellow. And I remember Black people living in the apartment complex were always razzing him, giving a bad time for living with that spick and that monkey. And the fact that he was Mormon, that was just horrible.
Oh, but that's fun. But the kind of comments I'm talking about are from people we don't even know. When we walk down Crossroads Mall and these white people are sitting on the benches smoking the cigarettes, or, you know, I don't know, maybe they've got garments on. What the heck? It doesn't matter. But you walk by them and their mommy, their little blonde mommies, oh, children, there goes a prostitute. Well, why would they say this person is a prostitute? Just because she's Black? Or the stares that you get when you walk into McDonald's is like, okay, we're watching a movie. There's a Black person over there, you know. And you just kind of, I don't know, maybe I'm sensitive, maybe I'm paranoid, but it just seems to be a phenomenon. When I was in California, living in Sacramento, the Oakland area, I mean, it was like everybody knows the Oakland Raiders. You know, everybody's seen the Rams. Everybody watches Bill Cosby. We don't have any problems with what a black person is. But it's like, here, do people turn the TVs on? You know, have you ever picked up a magazine? Do you ever pick up people? Hey, you know, what's going on out here? You know, do you want to touch me? You know, what can we do to help you? I was in the bathroom, little white boy was in there, and he was just kind of, I was in the mirror, you know, the mascara and the eyelashes and the makeup, and this little boy is just like, and I said, you want to touch me? You know, and you just think, what can I do to help them? I tried teaching primary, and those poor things, they just cried when I picked them up. They're scared to death. They stare at you. And why? We know you're big and you're soft like a mommy, but you're weird, you know. And perhaps I am. But just, you know, all of these things, we try to idealize them, and we try to fit in. We try to blend in. I mean, what can we do? You know, when I was even a non-LDS little girl, I was about in third grade, and these kids, they rubbed Comet on me, and they put Clorox on me, and hey, you know, it just doesn't come off. People were stuck. Take me as I am. Yes, ma'am.
Why would you want to join a church that has taught us, which I don't believe the other side, that you were inferior, you were being punished. What is there in the Mormon Church that you
want to become with us? There's one God, and if there's, you're the only ones that has this God, and you have the way to this God. I think at the time I joined the church, I said, yeah, I'll sacrifice all. I'll be persecuted. I'll be ridiculed, even by my own family, who sent me to psychologists saying, you've got a persecution complex, you have masochistic tendencies. And I said, well, okay, the Savior himself, they thought he was crazy. You know, this guy let himself get nailed on a cross. I mean, you know, he didn't even collect insurance. And I thought, okay, if it's worth it, if he's really there, if he's going to forgive me of my sins, and I can do all of these things, repent, strive to put forgiveness in my heart, to love people, yeah, I'll go for it. And I did. I tried it, went through the temple, paid my tithing, did everything. But I'm burnt out now. I'm disfellowshipped now. I can't stand it anymore. I'm ready for the insane asylum. Every day I walk the streets, I expect a white van drive by and say, okay, Victoria, come on, let's go.
What caused you to get out?
The loneliness, just the isolation, nobody to really relate to. I mean, the loneliness, seeing my friends raising their kids by themselves and just looking at all these white women, and I have this vision that when we get the Celestial Kingdom, these white women are going to look at,
oh dear, I was married an earth wife, you know. And, well, you know, and you guys are always ahead of us, and we have to catch up with you. And we can never do that. We're always behind you.
Mm-hmm. Mormons make you feel like this.
Mm-hmm. Mormons do, because you've had this wonderful gospel. You've had all these dreams for so long. And we want those dreams too. And it seems like our history has kept us from getting those dreams.
Natalie? No, Natalie wanted to...
I just wanted to answer her question from my point of view. First of all, I didn't grow up with a lot of negativeness. I grew up with a lot of positiveness. I had instilled in me growing up a lot of self-pride. So that when I joined the church, it didn't have anything to do with... First of all, the only Mormons I knew prior to joining the church was the Osmond family. So... And that was only because I went to a concert once and they gave me a Book of Mormon. But other than that, I wasn't familiar with the priesthood issue. I wasn't familiar with any racism. And as far as the Mormon Church goes, I grew up with racism. But in spite of all the racism I grew up around, we had to lay on the floor while the Ku Klux Klan shot through our windows. In spite of all of that, it made me the person I am today. It made me the person that I was when I finally decided to talk with the missionaries. When they came to my house, the reason I joined the church didn't have anything to do with negativeness. It had to do with the beauty of those two young men. It had to do with what they gave me, And what happened was they kept coming to my house, and I kept saying, I'll be right back. I'll be right back. And I'd leave. And I wouldn't come back till late at night. For two weeks. I'll be right back. I mean, as soon as I'd open the door, I could be right in the middle of cooking. I'd go turn off the stove. I'll be right back. Stay right here. I'll be right back. And I'd leave. 2 weeks later, they came to my door and followed me. And I turned around and I said, if you can tell me how Jesus Christ managed to teach the people on the American continent from Jerusalem, I'll sit and hear anything you have to say. Because I was born and raised in the Catholic Church. And what puzzled me from the time I was very little, I used to always ask my mother, what happened? Did they send telegrams? How did Jesus Christ teach these people here? How did we learn about Jesus Christ? Nobody ever for me. And these young men had an answer to give me. And I was so shocked because he flaps out this pamphlet that says Christ in America. I said, oh, because you see, I was throwing a question that nobody had ever answered. I did not expect to receive an answer from them. When they gave me the pamphlet, and they gave me a Book of Mormon and outlined Christ in America in the Book of Mormon and said, read this and we'll come back. Well, I read the pamphlet first, and I was very excited about it. And so I did listen to him. So when I joined the church, because I had a testimony that it was true. I didn't join the church. I beg to differ, but I would never in my life have joined any organization just because I have never felt like white people were superior to me. Therefore, if I had felt like these young men were saying to me, you are beneath us. We have this to offer to you so that you can come to our level. Then I would have said, later for you. But I didn't. What they gave me was love. What they showed me was a truthfulness that I believed in. It wasn't until I came to Utah that I experienced any negativeness. And like the young man who was sitting back there said, the most negativeness aside from the Mormons that I was with, that my son experienced, was from non-black members in Utah. They could not believe that I had joined the Mormon Church. And I had a bumper sticker on my car that I had gotten in Ohio that said, America's Witness for Christ, the Book of Mormon. I was proud of that. I was proud of being a Mormon. And they ripped it off my car. So then I began to experience then negativeness, but like I said before, it only made me stop and think, did I join a different church? So, but then my study, what happened then after I had never sat and totally read the entire Book of Mormon prior to that. What happened after being here and during that 6 month of my transition here, I read the entire Book of Mormon and the Bible, and I listened to tapes, and I thought, I know this is true. I know this is something that I want. So see, to me, as far as being prejudice against them, even now when I go to the temple for somebody to say, we're so glad you're here, it irritates me to think that they would have the nerve to say that to me, because I have as much right here as you do. But I smile, because it's all grin and bear it, or either walk through life with so much hatred that you waste so much of your life hating other people. It takes a lot of energy to hate. It takes a lot of energy. It takes so little energy to love somebody. And to me, it is a personal problem to the people who think they are superior to me. But I joined the church because I believe that it's true.
And I'd like to answer. Yeah. Go ahead. I'd like to answer that, both of those questions too. And for me, the positive part of being a member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, being a member of the church has taught me to slide over the negative things that have happened. And it's because of being a member that I can do that now. When I was in California, I was a Navy brat, so I was raised a lot of different places, and I grew up in a lot of different areas. And when someone was rude to us or when they were racial to us, it was nothing for us to think of the things that we would do to them and turn it into a joke. Otherwise, we would seriously rip throats out, you know, or just want to slap somebody down for whatever it was they were saying. And I'm so thankful that I never did that. That I thought, and I might have thought it, you know, but I'm real grateful that I never acted it out. I may have a couple of times, but not really that seriously. When I came to Utah, there were some racial things that happened, and some of the things that happen are so subtle that it can almost go unnoticed, except for someone that it's geared for. There was someone that told me one time that
an award activity that we were going to have a slave auction. And I sat there like, are you serious? And this lady was going on and on and on about having a slave auction. And to her, it was not a big thing. We were just going to do this, and we were going to sell members of the ward, and we were going to have them go out and do these activities and go into somebody's house and have them do all the slave things. And I sat there for a minute, you know, and I thought, Lord, help me not reach for her throat. And I was serious. I was hurt. I was hurt. And I was also real grateful that it wasn't one of my kids there that was listening to one of their leaders say this. Because then they would have really felt helpless, and they would have felt a lot more hurt than I would. And they would have had to deal with it when they got home. And I waited for her to finish. And when she did, she said, and you can do this, and you can do this, and you can do this, and you can do this. And she pointed to me, and she said, and you can do this. And I said, no, I won't do that. And she said, you mean you can't do it? And I said, no, I mean I won't do it. And she said, well, why not? And all I could, you know, it's like, grab her by the shoulders and just, you know, and I thought, I can't do that. I can't touch her. I can't put my hands on her. I can't even put my hands, take my hands out of my lap. And it's only because of my baptism in this church, and it's only because of the missionaries that I saw standing in a field in Montana that wanted to share a message with me about the Savior coming to this country, coming to America, and about how I could redeem myself if I became a better person, if I even tried to become Christ-like. I didn't have to do all the things that we talked about doing to white people that were being that rude to us when I was growing up. And all I could do was lean over and say, think about it. And I gave her a minute. And from here, it took almost a full minute, the red started to climb up her face. And I just sat there and looked at her. You know, it's like that kind of subtlety, and it's that kind of ignorance, and that kind of, Lord, give me strength, that happens in the church from church members. But it's because of the missionaries that we have out in the field, and it's because of members that are out in the field away from this area, away from Zion, and I'm not even sure what it is. Coming here is a whole different ball game when you're a member of the Church of Jesus Christ. It's a whole different ball game. It's a whole different church. But it's still the same feeling that I have of being a member. It's the same activities that I'm involved in. It's the same gospel. It's the same prophet that's leading us. It's the same kind of members. It's just that some are more sensitive than others. You know, and I think some are more traveled than others, and some are not as haughty as others, which is the way the world is anyway. But there's something very strange about being here. But I really believe, as I said in my opening statement, that it might be our test, and it might be your test that we're here. Whatever it is, it's something that we have to do together. It's really in our lives can help us get through it. There have been enough negatives that have happened that would make a normal person walk away and say, I have no idea why I did that, you know? But I'm not doing that because the gospel is true, and because it is right, and because this is what the Savior wants me to be doing. You know, I came, my mother saw me after I had joined the church, and she looked at me and she said, I know you're happy now. I won't be worried about you anymore. And it was the first time, I mean, I had two children that were teenagers, and she said this to me. And it was the first time that I can remember she actually looked at me and was not worried. And she wasn't going to be worried about me anymore. And I thought about all the trials and all the travels that I had taken and been on with her grandchildren, you know, and worried this woman half to death, not really thinking about it. And not really thinking about it until I became a member of this church and started being a little more considerate about who I was dealing with. And having, when I first joined the church in Montana, I was living in an open-ended garage when the missionaries came to visit me. And they gave us one of the lessons in that, the first lesson in that garage. And a couple were in a tent One was in a van, one was out in a field, and we were trying to homestead this 10 acres of land, and they came and they never once made fun of us. They did after we joined, but before then, they never did. And these are my friends, you know, they're still my friends. I love teasing them and giving them a hard time, but they never once made any kind of comment that made me question their sincerity. And even about all the times that we had together, one of them would take walks with my daughter, who was too young to be baptized at the time, but so he would take her for a walk and teach her gospel stories, while the other missionary taught my oldest daughter and I. And it was wonderful. I mean, he never got into any kind of racial thing at all. And unbeknownst to us, we got all the lessons except one. And we didn't know we didn't get one lesson. How are we going to know that? And the one lesson that we didn't get was about the priesthood. And the day we got it was the day of the revelation, because that's the day that they came barreling down. And I'm going to tell the story. They came so fast in their car up this little dirt road. I mean, dirt and dust was flying everywhere. And they wanted to tell us about the revelation. And we wanted to tell them that we wanted to be baptized. And he said, well, we'll give you the last lesson. And they could do it then, because they weren't sure how they could tell me about the priesthood issue. And I'm real, and see, Heavenly Father works in wonderful ways, because I'm not sure how I would have handled it. I know that when they did tell me, standing out in this person's driveway that day, that the church was now open to every worthy male, no matter what color. And I said, well, of course. Really? Why? I mean, what's the big deal? And it didn't even dawn on me that was like this big deal, you know, until someone told me that where they were when they heard the revelation, they were in Provo and horns were honking and people were crying, and I'm going, what is the big deal? I mean, it's 1979 or 78. What is the big deal? Well, it was a big deal, and people were really getting into it, and it was that kind of feeling that was coming from different people, from their heart, that touched me also, that made me want to be involved in this organization. It was the love that was coming from the members in Montana that made me know that they were sincere about their feelings toward me as a person. They wanted me as a person to be involved in the organization they were involved in. Nothing about skin color at all. Nothing. And I knew they had lost it when they gave me a 12-inch little piece of material. They wanted me to embroider it. You got to be joking. I'm straight off the street. I haven't been dry that long. I'm a recovering alcoholic, done a lot of different kinds of drugs, and now you want me to take a little needle and a thread and put a design on this little piece of cloth. And I thought, oh Lord. And then they wanted me to go in and teach these little children, these little sunbeam children, teach them about Jesus. Teach them about the love of Christ. Teach them out of this book this thick. You know what I'm saying? These little kids, you want me to teach these little kids? And they said, yeah. I have not had these lessons. And they said, don't worry, it'll come. And they put me in this room with these little 3 and 4 year olds, you know, and I'm like, I don't know how I'm going to do this. But they taught me that you can do anything if you pray about it. Anything. And I'm telling you that when I walked out of that room that first day, I was sitting on the floor with these little kids, because, I mean, I was too nervous to sit on a chair and try and be their teacher. I sat down on the floor with them. I could sit with kids and try to be their friend. It was a whole different world that was opening up for me. And I had tried to be positive. I had stopped taking drugs. I had stopped drinking. I had been a vegetarian. I had been fasting. All these things before I joined the church. That was part of my recovery process for me. I am a health nut. And this started before I joined the church. So a lot of the things that I learned in joining the church were not new to me at all. But the very basic things were religious were new to me. The spirituality I already had.
But the religious part of it was the part that I had been shunning for years. I was not about to join any organization, and my parents knew that. I'd walked away from the Baptist organization. And so here I was in the Mormon church. And I'm telling you that no matter what kind of negatives come from anybody, anywhere, but especially from the members, it can be handled. And it can be handled in such a way that score one for Christ. Mm-hmm. I really feel like I did it His way, because if I didn't, there'd be a body over here and I'd be in handcuffs over here, mm-hmm. you know? And it's not even that I would take it that far. It's just that's that feeling that comes from way down inside. It's like, how can you even be thinking that way? How can you even, I mean, where does that come from? How can you conjure up stuff like that? Go ahead.
Church, you don't have to be black or respect or whatever. We get it too.
Mm-hmm.
And the judgmental part, the non-accepting part, because we're not little cookie cutter children of Mormons or whatever.
Right.
We have all
the
three.
I thought I wasn't going to get into the Celestial's Kingdom because I couldn't bake bread. You heard that one before. And my children said, "Mom, another hockey puck we don't need." Someone back there had a question? You know, the amazing thing about this issue is that it's not just a racial issue, because a lot of the things that I felt have been directed toward me racially have also been felt by white single members of the church. And so they can relate to what we're saying. And it's really amazing. I've talked to different people for whatever reason to try and find out. I said, you know, it's really strange how when I came to Utah, and this is a prime example, I think. I've never lived any place where pedestrians bowed their head when they got ready to walk off the curb. You know, it was like, I am going to the Celestial Kingdom. And they just take off. And it's like, you know, when cars come to a screeching halt, you know, and I stand back and I'm going, how can they do that? This lady said to me one day, you just have to walk out there. And I said, no, my mom never raised me to be a moving target. So I'll just let you go ahead. But I want to say haughtiness, but it's not even haughtiness. It's like, I know I'm going to the Celestial Kingdom, or I know that I am so choice that nothing can touch me. And to me, that's what I'm looking at, you know, is that kind of behavior. And it's amazing to me that there aren't more people laying in the street, you know, but it's that kind of behavior, I think, that comes in conversations, too, with me and with other people that are different for whatever reason, that don't have a husband, don't have children, that don't want to make the bread, that don't want to be married, that don't want to go to the temple, any of these things that are supposedly norm for the church, they don't want to do, and that makes us set apart from others. So we can feel when you're sincere. And if somebody walks up, like Natalie was saying, how irritating it is for people to walk up, it's so good to see you here. And I understand that's, you know, that maybe that person doesn't know anything else to say but wants to get close and wants me to know that she's happy that I'm here, and you know, and I understand that, and all you have to do is just, I love to give them a little hug, you know, and you never argue with a little lady in the temple anyway. It's not good. Yes. Never.
I have a two-point question, frankly, about the field of California
and scams.
Yeah.
First of all, I'll answer your question, but the first point to me, what's important is that you know I'm black.
Mm-hmm.
That's important to me. See, because what I experience is a blending, which I don't mind assimilating, because that's my nature. I can go anywhere in the world and assimilate within that culture. But I want you to know that I am black, and I am proud of being black. I would not have it any other way. I am sure that in the pre-existence I said, send me down there as a black single parent. I can handle it. I didn't know what I was asking, but I still am sure that I said that. But see, that's the thing that I don't know if Marvin and Victoria experience it, but the thing that I experience is that people say, I never noticed that you were black, but I want you to notice that I'm black.
Just don't get hung up on it.
Right, don't let it become a personal thing with you, because that's what it becomes, a personal thing. But as far as interracial That is so personal. Mm-hmm. As far as interracial relationships, that is such an individual thing. And what I mean by it, I really don't want to touch it, but I have to say this much. I have seen a lot of young black women join the church and come to Utah looking for a white husband. I have seen a lot of black men join the church looking for a white wife. And what is sad about that, in my case, I was born and raised in an all-black Catholic environment all my life. And I was not raised to be prejudiced. I wasn't racial. When I was a senior in high school, I chose to be prejudiced for a year. I had the worst headaches, and it was so much energy for me to be prejudiced that I would never even choose that route again. But I did choose it on my own. I have two uncles that are married, that are interracially married, and have been for some 30-odd years. But to come anywhere, to be anybody, black or white, and decide, I am going to marry a white person, or I am going to marry a black person, to be so narrow-minded that you are not open to someone. I mean, I don't know if I would ever marry a white man, but I'm certain that if a white man came up and sat next to me and began to talk to me, I wouldn't say, oh, I better not get too close to him, because I might fall in love with him. But I, you know, my whole, it's so individual. So many people are just really lax in it. And it's not like, unlike Victoria was talking about, I didn't grow up when I joined the church, everybody just said, oh, there's Natalie doing something different again. Mm-hmm. So there was no negativeness, even though my entire family are very devout Catholics. It wasn't bad that I did that, to join the church. And I dated a white man once, not because he was white, but because that's what I chose to do, and nobody in my family ever said to me, why are you dating that white man? It was friends, people around me, who said, what are you doing? Why are you doing that? And I think that it's just so individual, and that you make your own choices in life, and you, and if you fall in love with someone of a different race, so be it, be happy. And I think it's so important to have the very love of Christ within any relationship, whatever it may be. If Christ is the center of that relationship, it's going to last in spite of anybody around you and any prejudices they have. So let me repeat it first. Are you saying to me, do I think that in the pre-existence I was not black? And also the second part of the question is, do I believe that when I die I am not going to be black?
Yeah.
Are those the questions that you're asking me?
Yeah.
Wow. And the only reason I'm saying wow is because I just had this conversation with a girl at work. And I believe, I mean, I know, you know, it's so... In the pre-existence, I believe that I was who I am. When I die, I believe I'm going to be who I am. And that's the only way I can answer that question for you. You know, if that doesn't answer, I'm sorry, but I can't get too deep into that because I do get deep into it. And so I don't want to... Thank you. I'm glad.
Yes. You had a second question?
Yes, I have a question. Yeah, feeling of prison, is that a
general way to come? Well, I don't feel you like that. I think it's a background thing. I think, see, a lot of things, and I think it has to do with what makes you negative, what makes a person decide. I mean, I know a lot of black people who have joined the church and left the church because of something someone said to them. A month after they join the church, and they are still inactive 5 years later, and yet they will say to you, oh, I believe it's true, but I'm never going back to the church because that bishop said this to me. And I think that to be so negative within yourself that you feel like, oh, I am black, or oh, I am Mexican, or oh, I am Tongan, and because I am, I'm going to be treated this way. And I was never, and maybe that's within people, because I was never raised that way. I was raised that you are important, and you can be whoever you're going to be. And you deserve all the good things in life just like anybody else. So I can't even relate to her saying that because she expected that. I just can't even relate to that.
I can relate to her saying it because I've done a lot of counseling myself in the past, and I understand the depths of despair people are in when they don't feel like they deserve anything. And I think a lot of my drinking had to do with that. With that feeling within myself, where I didn't believe that I deserved any better than I was giving myself, and which is really a sad place to be. And I mean, you've got to. I mean, it's one thing to pull yourself up by the bootstraps and go on. You know, it's one thing to say that. It's one thing to say that.
But was it because you were black?
No, but if that's the only issue that I can come up with, mm-hmm. then that's going to be the one that's dominant. You know, If it's because if I'm not feeling that proud of being black, then that's probably going to be the reason that I think this is happening to me. If it's because I don't feel that terrific about being a parent, then it's probably directed at me because I'm a single parent. But it takes so much love and so much attention to try and convince a child that he really is loved. You know how kids go through this thing where, are you really coming back? You know, are you coming back? Yes, I'll be back. Don't ask me that again. I'll be back. But to convince them that you really are coming back and you really do love them, it's all these reassuring things that they need to hear as they're going through life. And if they don't hear it, then that there's a void there. And they're not going to be very sure about that as they grow up into being an adult, even if somebody else is telling them that. So yeah, I can relate to what she's saying. In fact, that was one of the, that whole scenario right there was one of the reasons I had such a hard time watching Roots. And it's because of, like, the women got on the block to be sold and they were being poked and tested for their effectiveness or their ability to be sold, what kind of price they would bring. And I thought about that very kind of thing and people that go through that kind of thinking in their lives. It is real sad. It's real tough. And it's real tough to get them past that point. You know, they need a lot of reassurance, and it comes from way deep inside. Yes. I have to
teach them to be proud of who they are.
Right.
And
so
because...
My children and I have talked about that too, and I thought occurred to me one day, if Heavenly Father made a whole field of flowers and they were all different colors, why would He zap it all into one color? You know, it doesn't make any sense to me. If we're all made in His image, it's got to be from within, you know, because there's too many differences without, on the outside, and I can't believe that we would go through this existence doing the best that we can and being the best we are, making up the best we can, you know, making us look good on the outside and feeling good on the inside. And then he would just, you know, with a snap of his finger, make us all one color and all alike. It just doesn't make any sense.
I agree.
How do we get to that point, though, was this lady's question. How do we get there? What did these people do that was so different than what's being done in Utah or other parts of the United States? What can we do to get to that point to where here in Salt Lake, Ensign Ward, it's half black, half white, hair is groovy? What can we do? I mean, we've been asking that since we've been
members.
I think
that's a lot to do with color acceptance, too. Mm-hmm. I think you're a pioneer, too. I really do. I believe it's going to be people like you that help people like us stay here, you know, and be able to do what the Savior wants done. Because I don't know that, you know, if you stop and think about the problems and the experiences that black people are going through in the church now, I don't know that the church is ready for a lot of black people to join here in the United States, because if I've had to squelch a lot of anger and to learn how to rethink my thinking in order to accept what I'm hearing, that's what I heard a lady say in Oakland, you know, and she said, and one of the members said, gee, won't it be great if we can get all of Oakland? I mean, Oakland is 85% black. Why couldn't all of them be in the church? And she said, I don't know if you want all those junkies and prostitutes in here. You know, and that's what it's really coming down to. If the gospel is going out to every nation, kindred, tongue, and people, that's going to mean prostitutes, pimps, junkies, addicts, a lot of people that are out there that are hurting, that need to hear what we've got, and that need to share what we have, and we need to enfold them. And when they come in, you know, they're going to be a lot more militant than me and Natalie and Victoria, you know.
But also in answer to the question, how would we get more black people in the church? I think that as black people, it is our responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
Because I feel just the black people that I grew up with, if one of you were to go eliminating a few of you. But if one of you white people in this room were to go and try to teach them anything, they wouldn't even talk to you. Mm-hmm. They wouldn't even look at you. They would feel like, here is white supremacy trying to make me do what they're doing once again in my life, because so many black people are walking around negative as it is. Mm-hmm. They're walking around saying, I'm not, they're on welfare. I'm not going to work for the white man. Why should I work for the white man? But I will take his free monthly check every month. He owes it to me. So in order, I think that it is our responsibility. I'm not saying our responsibility alone, but I've met so many black members of the church who become members of the church and don't want anything else to do with their black counterparts anymore. This is where I'm at. They're just going to pull me down, so why should I even bother? Whereas actions speak louder than anything. Mm-hmm. When my mother died 2 years ago and I went to Ohio and my whole family was falling apart because they couldn't handle it, the gospel is what made me get through it. The gospel is what helped me. And in just the way that I, through the gospel, handled her funeral and the arrangements and everything, and I had so many people coming to me and say, whatever church that is, it has really done good for you. And I think just the examples that we give. Mm-hmm. Why don't you send me a couple of books? I mean, I sent about 50 Book of Mormons after I got back here. And as hard as it was for me and the things that I went through, just my example, just knowing that, I mean, when I came here, they said, oh, you're going to Utah? Are there any black people there? I mean, they made a joke out of it. I went back the first Christmas I was here, and they made a joke out of it. We went to a party, and the guy said, here's Natalie, she's from Utah, didn't know there were any black people in Utah. You know, just made a big joke. But I think it is our responsibility to share the gospel. If we're pioneers, then we need to do the pioneering thing. We need to be out there, and we need to be showing the gospel in our actions more than anything else.
I hear it a lot, too, working reservations for Eastern Airlines. And I work right here in Salt Lake City. And when people make a local phone call from anywhere between Washington, D.C. and Seattle, Washington, they're making a phone call to make a reservation for Eastern, and they say, where are you? And I'll say, in Salt Lake. And if it's a black person that's on the other end of the line, you're kidding. You're not out there with those Mormons. I said, yeah, but we don't bite. We don't bite. And they get it, you know, and it opens the door for me to talk to them. And they're absolutely flabbergasted, not only that I'm a Mormon, but I'm living in Utah, and what's out there, you know, is why don't you come out and see? And I'll tell them where I'm at, and it's really neat how many... Maybe I don't sell as much for Eastern, you know, but I sure do for the church. Yes.
I remember years ago hearing people like looking at documentaries about India, saying, "Oh, those poor people! If only they joined in church, they become, you know, American middle class and they have living better."
Yeah.
I have two questions. One is, to whom in the black community is the church appealing? Is it the middle class? Is it the junkies and prostitutes, other ends of the spectrum? And do you feel pressure to become white middle class that the image of the church is?
Are black yuppies.
The church, I believe, from the information that I'm getting through Ebony Rose, I'm able to travel around and, well, through Eastern I'm able to travel, but through Ebony Rose I'm able to meet a lot of different people. And I see from junkies and addicts and middle class and even upper class black people that have joined the church. What was the second part? Oh, no. I mean, I hardly ever feel any pressure anyway, because there's not enough time. You know, there's just, when I first joined the church, well, actually when my children were born, I remember looking at them and thinking, golly, I'm a parent now, I'm a mother, and I'm going to do everything I can to take care of you and to make life really neat. And my whole life has been to make sure that they had a good time and to make sure that they knew that they could go out and get whatever they could, even if I didn't. Because I didn't take management jobs on purpose, because I wanted to spend time with them, more so after I joined the church. I still had opportunities to go for management positions, but I even went on welfare for 5 years so that I could spend time with my children, because it was important to me. And I think the gospel, people that hear the gospel, people that the gospel goes to aren't going to, when they listen to it and hear the truthfulness of it, they're not going to spend a lot of time evaluating it, because you can feel it from inside. You know, you just know that this is what you're supposed to be doing. And it's out there for everyone. And one little statement that I wanted to make about that too was that I get comments from people that say, Marva, I've got this friend that's black, and I was given your phone number by somebody that knew you 5 years ago, and I have this friend that's black, and I don't know what to say to them about the church. And I said, well, you don't really say anything that's different. You know, you don't, I mean, there's not one message for black people, and there's not another message for Hispanic, and there's not another message for whites. It's just whatever the message is from our Father in heaven is what the message is, and you give it to them. So scoot, you know, and it really is that simple. We don't speak, I mean, we do speak another language, but it's not that hard, you know, to understand. But it's the little subtle things that come from people that can stop someone from accepting the gospel, that the gospel message. But it's out there for everyone, and they're picking it up fast. Yes.
Yes, you, honey bunny.
I just wanted to say, maybe it would help to think of it as the difference between us is a little black pagan that you could pile on a nickel.
That what? That you could pile on a nickel?
Yes.
All right. Wow.
That's the difference between us.
Wow. It really will fit on a nickel.
She's so funny.
Yeah. That's amazing, yes.
What's your comment on feeling?
I have the same feeling as Natalie. I don't want you to be blind to my color. I'm real proud of it. And I can't do a whole lot about it. So, you know, I mean, people that come up and say, I don't know that, I can't see that you're black. That's, to me, it's like, I mean, I had a friend one time, we were friends for 3 years before we ever even mentioned color. And it happened in the weirdest way, because her and I had come to pick her up, and I had a station wagon, and I had it packed full of kids, and I don't even know where all these kids came from, but I was always driving around like that. And this was when I was on welfare, and so I went to pick up my friend and her daughter, and we were going to take all these kids somewhere. And she got in the car and she said, well, who's the little kid back there? And I said, great, Liz, there's about 15 kids back there. And she said, well, the one with the curly hair. And I'm trying to drive and look in the mirror. And I said, Liz, I don't know which, give him a name, ask him his name so I'll know who you're talking about. And she kept fumbling in something descriptive to make him stand out. And she finally said, well, he's black. And I said, really? You know, I hadn't even thought about it. I didn't know who this kid was. And for the first time, she looked at me and she goes, Marva, you're black. And I said, wow, can you imagine that? But we hadn't talked about it. It had never come up in our 3 years. And we were close friends. We were together all the time. Her daughter and mine were like sisters. And it was amazing to us that it hadn't come up. But she wasn't blind. She just didn't care.
Well, you know, is it that she didn't care, or she didn't know how to approach it? She was embarrassed.
No, it wasn't that. It wasn't that.
She tried to ignore it.
Nope, it wasn't that. It
see,
didn't
I'm just the
matter.
Opposite. This is where I would like to be, where it doesn't make any big deal if you're Chinese, if your eyes are slanted, if your hair is blonde. That's what I like.
Well, see, and I have my own problems with some races, just because of where black people have been in this country and where other races are now coming here and are able to attain. And it bothers me a little bit, but it's something that I need to get over too. So I notice mm-hmm. some other races, and I notice
see,
people's
can,
races.
Appreciate our, what you're probably saying is that we can appreciate who we are, appreciate our culture, and still be accepted for what we are.
Mm-hmm. Golly,
still
I hope
be,
so.
Yeah.
I hope
that would
so.
Be the
yeah,
idea.
Because it's not, it can't be that important. I mean, there's too many other things that are. We can't spend a lot of time worrying about my color and your color. I mean, we can talk about it if it's something that's going to help you get closer to me. But and I'm willing to do that, and that's what this is all about today. But I'm sure if you and I exchange phone numbers and we continue to talk over the years, we're going to soon burn out on talking about color. Yes?
I think, when I think about this idea, I think part of the thing is that when I have a friend, I don't think of this friend as being a black friend, or a girlfriend, or a philosopher friend, or a medical student friend. I think of them as a friend. And I think that's what people mean when they say, I don't think of you as black or white. I just think of you as a friend.
Mm-hmm. There was the church had a really neat spot on that, one of the Homefront series, where grandfather was out in the middle of this lake and he was fishing with his little grandson, and the grandson was saying about his little Indian friend, and his little Indian friend did this, and his little Indian friend did that, and his grandfather said, why can't he just be your friend, or something like that? And I thought, oh, that's so neat. I mean, those home front series always hit it right on the head.
And but it doesn't have to constantly be talked about, but it is mm-hmm. important that you are aware that that person is proud of their own individuality. Mm-hmm. And it's not, just like you said, it's not necessary for you to say, I have a black friend, and yeah, I have a Mexican friend, and I have a Tongan friend, and, you know, mm-hmm. this is my black friend so-and-so, you know. Does your black friend have a
yeah.
name?
Like, as soon as you do that, you just lost one.
And it's also important that that individual is aware that you are aware of who they are, and it doesn't matter, mm-hmm. but not that it is ignored. Mm-hmm. Do you know?
Yes. Oh.
The time's up. Probably some people may want to say.
Oh, is that what we're doing?
A lot of people may want to leave for the next session.
Okay.
What time is it?
10 o'clock.
Okay. Bye. I wanted to say, I think all of you are great. I appreciate the questions that you brought forth, too, because and what I would like to know is if you can take whatever you got here today and share it with somebody else. Thank you.